Go to any event where there's bluegrass music being played and you can see three or four generations worth of people either playing on stage, playing in the parking lot, playing around a campfire, playing in the halls, or all of the above. Acoustic roots music in general, and bluegrass especially, excels at attracting and fostering new generations of enthusiasts. And a big part of how it does this is not just because of the appeal of the music itself. Although the style obviously has staying power, the fact that there are so many young people taking it up has a lot to do with what bluegrass has learned over its now almost 80-year history. And two of the things bluegrass has learned is how to teach and how to make learning fun. This was not always the case. Take Earl Scruggs, for example. His 1968 instruction book, Earl Scruggs and the Five-String Banjo, sold over 1 million copies, but it was too advanced for most true beginners. While it offered a rare opportunity for outsiders to gain insight into the genre and learn from an icon about his instrument and songbook, it fell short in offering a way of understanding how to begin unlocking his mastery. That said, part of the reason why Earl Scruggs' book was groundbreaking had a lot to do with the fact that bluegrass was still only about 20 years old itself, and its culture and attitudes were far different than they are today. While bluegrass artists now, like any musicians really, are still competitive with each other, they are overall a much more genial bunch than they were when first generation stars would at times fight each other with more than just words, and at times hold grudges for years. Back then, being a professional bluegrass musician was more of a zero-sum game, with more territorial kinds of thinking than the sort of abundance mindset that prevails with so many today. While Earl Scruggs could certainly afford to share some of his secrets in his book, he was the exception to the prevailing rule. Part of the reason why we see such a robust culture of teaching bluegrass and an openness to bringing in outsiders in following decades has a lot to do with an artist who is a teacher and outsider himself, Pete Wernick. Dr. Banjo, as he is often called because of his PhD in sociology, began teaching banjo camps as far back as 1980. He's also written several books, produced many instructional volumes, both audio and video, and has developed his own school for bluegrass, the Wernick Method, teaching thousands of classes to many thousands more students across the world. And Pete Wernick has had about as good of a music career playing bluegrass and bluegrass-adjacent music as anyone not named Earl Scruggs. He was a founding member of progressive bluegrass pioneers Hot Rise. He ventured into jazz with his group Flexigrass, who you're hearing now from their album What The, with his composition Waiting for Daylight. He was a member of a supergroup with Steve Martin and Earl Scruggs. He was in a band with Jerry Garcia in 1963. And has played and recorded with other groups like Country Cooking and Long Road Home. He was also the first president of the International Bluegrass Music Association, serving from 1986 to 2001. It was at last fall's IBMA conference that we talked about all this and more. I'm your host, Joe Kendrick, welcoming you to our conversation and more of his music in our episode on Pete Wernick on Southern Songs and Stories.
Southern Songs and Stories is part of the podcast lineup of both Public Radio WNCW and Osiris Media. Osiris creates music podcasts and events to help music fans deepen their connection to the music they love with all of their shows at osirispod.com. Osiris works in partnership with Jam Bass, which connects music fans to the music they love and empowers them to go see live music. Capsule versions of Southern Songs and Stories are produced for broadcast on WNCW by me, Corey Askew. More information about this and other podcasts from Grassroots Radio WNCW at wncw.org.
The first multi-day bluegrass festival was promoted by Carlton Haney and situated on Cantrell's Horse Farm just north of Fincastle, Virginia in 1965. A young Pete Wernick, along with fellow New York banjoists Winnie Winston, Steve Arkin, and Marty Cutler, entered the banjo contest, where to his surprise, only Winston made the final round, and did not win. Being a student at Columbia University, where he was a DJ on radio station WKCR, he also brought a reel-to-reel tape recorder and managed to interview practically everyone there, including Jimmy Martin, Mac Wiseman, Don Reno, and Ralph and Carter Stanley, as well as the father of bluegrass, Bill Monroe. You could say that it was a learning experience. Here's Pete Wernick.
I used my deepest possible voice, which wasn't very deep. I have Bill Monroe correcting me. I have Carter Stanley correcting me because I called his music bluegrass and he didn't want it called bluegrass.
Oh, yeah.
He was very friendly, but he says, no, Pete, you know, we call it the old-time mountain music or something like that. So, I don't know, when you're trying to come up as a musician, it's great to have an understanding that's not just built on what you hear in the grooves of a record. But having seen a lot of them in person, being at that first festival and hearing them reminisce about the early days of bluegrass. See, 65 was the early days of bluegrass. Now it is. But in 65, the early days of bluegrass, you know, were the 40s and the 50s. And all these guys who are now passed away, every last one of them, were reminiscing about what it was like to travel with Bill Monroe and learn how to be accepted as a musician. And Hot Rise, we actually would listen to those tapes. We traveled around the first 2 years in a old Cadillac that Charles picked out, a really nice old Sedan DeVille. And then he put in a great sound system, and we traveled from Colorado out to the East Coast, the West Coast. And this is before the internet, way before. So we had a lot of cassettes of the best music that we could gather, we did, and we would listen to that a lot. And then I'd also bring along the recordings so we would remember what different famous stars said about this or that, and we would quote those things to each other.
Wow.
Like I'll tell you, this is a funny little example. James Monroe at the time was making his way as a good band leader, and I interviewed him about singing, and one of the things I asked him was, James, what kind of song do you like to sing? And he says, I like a sad song. He says, I don't like no happy song. He says, now what's that kind of song that Jimmy Martin does? I say, novelty? And he goes, yeah, I hate that. That's something that his dad would do, too. He'd get somebody else to name something because he didn't want to say it himself, and then he'd say he hated it. But that was the kind of thing that Hot Rise would quote to each other. And this is all part of the folklore and all the things that go with the dedication to the music itself. You get to know the people and where it came from. And that's always been a delight for me. I'm from New York City originally, and the South is just a real interesting place, and I got pretty interested in it, and I come down this way frequently and have enjoyed it a lot.
So, Pete, you're naturally curious, and that's obvious from just, you know, the most recent example of attending the radio panel here at IBMA, mm-hmm. and I've seen you out at IBMA and at other events where you've been catching music late night, catching an up-and-coming artist. And so that makes me think that there's an obvious tie between your teaching and your innate curiosity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my dad was an exceptional teacher. He taught math, and I really respected how he was able to connect with students, even with math, and they would... He changed a lot of lives for people, and I just came to realize I had a penchant for teaching. And when somebody asked me to teach them to play banjo, I had taught myself to play banjo because there was no instruction available when I was learning in the early 60s. But then I figured out slowly but surely how to teach it. And just in general, when I see somebody struggling to do something and I know how to do it, I'd like to help them. And learning how to be a band or learning how to be a performer and live the performer's lifestyle is not so obvious. And so currently there's three different young men who I'm mentoring. Both of all three of them have a real future in bluegrass. I don't even want to name them, but you have heard of some of them or will hear of some of them. But I really like approaching them, or somehow or other I get to know them, and then it turns out they want to know a lot of stuff about what it takes to move ahead. So actually I wrote a book years ago called How to Make a Band Work, which had a lot of what I learned from being in Hot Rise in there. But I'm one of these people I'm mentoring is a teenager, and he's in high school, and he's a really good musician, and his mother is very active in wanting to help him do a good job. And so I'm kind of mentoring her as well, because she's kind of his manager. And there's a lot to know about, of course, as a rising musician, but also any manager has to learn what's good to do and what's not, and especially if it's the mother of the performer. I've had a fair amount of exposure to various stage mothers who, you know, you meet them and you practically get the resume of the child of the stage mother. It could be a stage dad too. They're there too. Anyway, so and they listen. That's the part I like. They listen. If I'm offering information and people take it to heart and use it, and then get some success with it, that's the kind of thing. You know, people say, "Oh, you can take that to the bank." Well, I can take it to the grave is the way I think of it, because when I'm down to my last few hours or days, I know I'll be trying to recontact in my mind what I've meant to people and in the field that I love deeply, which is bluegrass. If I've had a good effect helping people along, boy, that makes me feel good. And now my main occupation is overseeing a network of teachers who teach bluegrass jamming to the masses. So I'm mentoring some people who are pretty headed for heights in the business, but most people into bluegrass they have other jobs. They just like to play and they want to play better. And a lot of them are in need of some guidance, especially because it's sometimes tricky to connect with other musicians and play bluegrass, which is not a solo thing. It's a team sport. And yet it's generally taught as a solo venture, like people are learning how to solo by reading tablature and reproducing it, reciting essentially. And I have to take them, when people like that come to my classes or anybody's classes, you have to explain to them that it's not about reciting something that somebody else thought of. I mean, you're playing somebody else's song, but you're still, you're doing it your own way, just like it comes out in your handwriting, so to speak. And it's not just going to be a carbon copy. And getting people used to the whole way bluegrass is created, which is more like conversation, really, it turns out to be a bit of a discipline that I've taught myself over years of teaching that sort of stuff. So eventually I learned how to do it enough so that I realized I could teach it to other people, and there's a big demand for it.
That's a bit of the song Pow Wow the Indian Boy from Hot Rise's self-titled debut, written by Pete Wernick and showcasing a technique that he's well known for, which is playing through a phase shifter. I asked Pete about those early days in Hot Rise alongside Tim O'Brien, Charles Sawtelle, and Nick Forster, playing what I called a mostly unprecedented style, and how different their audience must have been from more traditional bluegrass fans.
I think it's not a whole lot different, because even when we started, Newgrass Revival had already been going for 7 years. And so there was a real progressive branch of bluegrass. Country Gazette was relatively progressive. And when you're trying to get a band to be popular, you don't really worry who they are. You just want more of them. So we got college gigs. That certainly helps get some young people interested. And then we played festivals and in different parts of the country. We made a point of getting to all parts of the country. We only missed two states, North Dakota and South Dakota, amazingly enough. That neighbors to Colorado, but we never took a gig in South Dakota. But we played all the other states, played a lot of other countries, and our performing style was such that we could attract people who were not the mainstream people. We knew enough solid traditional bluegrass and do it well, I think, to where the experienced bluegrass heads could say, these guys know what they're doing, even if they are from Colorado and they all wear glasses. But we'd always have people come up and say, well, I don't like bluegrass, but I like you guys. That's kind of a left-handed compliment. And then one thing that really changed was everybody in our band had a pretty good sense of humor. And as you travel around in bands, and any band knows this, you share some humor. Actually, I was going to say all bands do this. Well, a lot of bands have taken to everybody's listening to their own on their own headphones to something, and they're not talking. We didn't have that. We just would listen to stuff together and talk, and then we'd make up stuff that would make each other laugh. And we were just guys having fun on the road. And that developed into what became known as Red Knuckles and the Trailblazers, which is somebody who sounds an awful lot like Tim O'Brien singing in a different register, doing songs from 50s country music. And everybody in our band assumed an identity of somebody in this band that played the old hits of country music. And then humor sort of started penetrating that whole situation. And there's a lot of humor that when Red Knuckles took the stage, people really got into. And then we'd find that really opened up our audience, because a lot of the older guys just love bluegrass, but if they want to go to the festival, mom doesn't want to really come along. Maybe it's because the bathrooms aren't any good or whatever, maybe, you know. And then the kids don't have anything to do, even though they say it's a family festival. That means there's video games in this room. But kids would get dressed up as cowboys to sit in front of Red Knuckles and the Trailblazers. And I think, you know, I don't want to sound sexist or anything, but I think women like it when guys make fun of themselves. I think they just do. And also dress well. I mean, we always wore suits when we were playing at festivals. And we really were aware of wanting to be of appeal to families. Because if the whole family goes, and it's not just dad who's allowed to go on Saturday, but the whole family goes for the weekend, that's ka-ching, which also is an outdated term now. Because there's no sound when you put your credit card on a machine.
It's more like bloop.
Right. But ka-ching has an old-time meaning, which the younger listeners will have to find out on their own. But anyway, it helped us be successful. And then the word travels, and then people hear that there's humor involved in the show and just different aspects that sort of tend to broaden the audience. And the songs we wrote and chose were... We didn't really want to sing. I mean, I have a cabin that I practice in. I love cabins. But most people don't live in cabins anymore. So if you're singing about a cabin, you're kind of antiquated. But like a song like Tim O'Brien wrote, Untold Stories or Walk the Way the Wind Blows, those are completely contemporary. They're about things that happen today to anybody, whether they spend all day in a cubicle wearing a suit or whether they're out in the fields plowing, it's still the same kind of stuff that means something to people. So if you have material that is not just focused on a narrow part of the world, so to speak, you might find a broader appeal. And a lot of these songs actually are now being done by a lot of people at jam sessions, which is wonderful as far as I'm concerned, you know, because that's how the legacy gets spread, is when you create material and popularize material that other people then do. Then you know that after you're dead and gone, there'll still be people playing those songs, and that's a good feeling to know about that. So you add all that stuff up together, and that answers the question as well as I can, that you asked about, you know, what's the audience like. And at the radio panel today, they were talking about broadening the appeal to the younger set. And I think nobody said this, but I know that one great way to appeal to the younger set is putting out a really good teenage band and sending them around. Because when teenagers see people their grandpa's age playing, that doesn't mean as much to them as people their own age playing and really pulling it off and sounding great and getting attention for it. That makes people, now they have somebody to focus on. So like a band like Nickel Creek brought a tremendous number of young people in, and that tells you a lot about how it can spread. And as far as I'm concerned, anybody of any shape, size, color, age, welcome. Listen to this. It's good. You ought to like it. I bet you'll like it if you give it a chance. And a lot of people do, so I'm happy about it.
Watch away the troubles, keeping us apart. Tell those untold stories, let the healing start. Now it's been so long ago that we went our separate ways, and now maybe time has changed us in one dirty way. You look the same as ever, and I'm glad you're here with me. Take a look into my eyes and tell me what you see. It's all those untold stories, all those silent lies. We'll never know each other, keeping up deep inside us. Wash away the troubles, keeping us apart. Tell those untold stories, let the healing start.
That's a bit of Untold Stories by Hot Rise, one of the songs Pete Wernick mentioned in our conversation. Lyrically, it's set apart from a great many songs that, even back in 1987 when it came out, tended to fetishize antiquated lifestyles. And that sort of thing is all the more obvious today, with all these old tropes repeatedly employed in new bluegrass music, and other styles of music too, for that matter. The push and pull between authenticity and progress in music dates back as far as anything considered a given style of music immediately after its birth. Just think of all the debates about when or how any given genre of music lost its way. How many lines have been drawn separating, say, rock music before and after the year 1974, and so on. I asked Pete Wernick about what I perceived as a kind of flip-flop with how original songs and traditional songs, as well as cover songs from other styles, were treated in bluegrass versus old-time music over time. I put forward that old-time more or less discouraged original songwriting up to a point, whereas bluegrass, while it had begun as a form that celebrated original compositions, has lately embraced more covers from outside the genre.
Well, I think it's all healthy because it's all human expression one way or another. And if people take the time to learn it and practice it and then present it, it must mean something to them. And then it's a question of finding the audience for that. Old-time music specializes in foot-tappable fiddle tunes. Well, so they play for dances a lot. And Monroe started playing as a kid. He was playing for dances a lot. And that's always been part of bluegrass, and he made sure it was part of bluegrass. And then there's just all kinds of other places to go with original material. The singer-songwriters came along in the 60s. You know, Bob Dylan really got something started there. Buffy St. Marie, you know, people like that. They're just writing songs about what was going on in their heart or just interesting things. And yeah, there's a lot of Bob Dylan songs in bluegrass. You can do Buffy St. Marie songs in bluegrass. You can do, well, I was shocked when Del McCurry is up there singing a song called Learning the Blues. And I'd heard it before, and I was wondering where in the, oh yeah, it was a hit in the 50s by Frank Sinatra. I remember because I used to listen to the Hit Parade when I was a kid, and that song was a good song by Frank Sinatra, and here's Del doing it. And it makes a good bluegrass song. So as Jimmy Martin said when I asked him what makes a song bluegrass, he says, well, it's got a banjo and a mandolin and a fiddle and a guitar and a bass. He said, any song can be bluegrass if you do that to it. Now, not every song has the right tempo for to work a banjo roll to it, but Scruggs and Reno and others were doing that in bluegrass in the 40s, like Farewell Blues is really a Dixieland tune from the 20s that Scruggs heard on a record that his uncle had, and he made it into an instrumental that people think is a Scruggs original, but it's another genre. And Don Reno did similar. And I don't know, things go back and forth all different directions with fashion. And at a certain point, it might have been considered kind of revolutionary to do Teach Your Children Well by Crosby, Stills, and Nash, and here you are playing a bluegrass-style country gazette. Well, it's a great song, is what it is. So you can do it with different kinds of instruments at different times. You know, put harmony on it or not. That's human expression for you, and bluegrass is broad enough to be able to take in a lot of that stuff, you know. It's great to think of all the examples of that. Ken Burns, when he did the 10-part series on country music, just covered so much ground with country music, and then there was a big chunk of it about bluegrass, and he made a point of showing how bluegrass came from a lot of different sources, and it gives back to those same sources. And then you have people who come to bluegrass later from other kinds of music even, and they want to learn bluegrass, but it's not so easy if you didn't grow up with it. But there's a lot of cross-pollination, and that's a very healthy thing. That it used to be like, oh, if you don't play this kind of bluegrass, you're not my kind of person, and I don't want you to even be here. And I don't think we see too much of that unless the younger set dances up a storm and raises dust and makes everybody have to deal with dust. So that's a good thing about it. I think bluegrass festivals are still one of the great places for people to get together and not just observe and get all worked up over somebody on stage. They're worked up about who they're with in the audience and who they're going to jam with later that night in the campground. So it's a more of a community venture than, say, a big crowd of people at the Metropolitan Opera or a rock concert. Although, I'm going on a tangent here, but, you know, Jerry Garcia, who I knew before he was in the Grateful Dead, he and I played music together and we had a little band in 1963 when he was just a struggling banjo player. And they were always at him and the other people I knew out in California that summer were always trying to find tapes of live shows because there was hardly anything on LP record at the time and they just couldn't find the music. So they had a lot of trades going with people trading tapes of live shows. So it was no surprise to me that when the Grateful Dead encouraged people to tape their shows, that I think I knew where that came from, so to speak. And then with everybody, you know, the Grateful Dead culture turned into a thing where half of it is about the audience seeing each other. And it's just a communal gathering. And that's somewhat similar to bluegrass festivals as well. And so those events usually are so gigantic that it's a little harder to have the kind of fun you can have at a bluegrass festival. But I think that they're both examples of people in society really needing to get together and celebrate something. And, you know, sports is one thing, but then you're against half the people there, you know, and somebody's going to lose, and nobody has to lose at a music event at all. So
I'd like your observations about some of those intersections with bluegrass, like you mentioned with Jerry Garcia. There's a plenty to go on as far as bluegrass being a gateway towards jam-oriented music, and that's happening in a big way today with, say, Billy Strings. But there have been lots and lots of examples of bluegrass artists crossing over into the country world and bluegrass artists crossing over into different, you know, rock groups and so forth. Mm-hmm. So I wonder what your sort of nutshell of that sort of phenomenon might be.
You know, the nutshell is kind of like, yes, that's true. It's just people being people, you know, just like humans started in Africa, but they ended up everywhere. You know, after a while, people find, I want to go where it's cold more of the time. I want to go where, you know, I can jump in the ocean anytime. So everybody spreads out and does their thing. So Stuart Duncan is on records with Yo-Yo Ma. And he's also, well, you know, I could give lots of examples, as you could too. And I think it's good, as long as there's bluegrass doesn't lose its identity, and it's not about to lose its identity. There's some people who just want to play and hear pure bluegrass, maybe not only, but if they're going to do it, they're really going to do it. And the Hot Rise was like that. When we did bluegrass, straight bluegrass, we wanted it to be straight bluegrass. We didn't want, maybe have our own touches on it, but it was not going to be a jazzed up version of Can't You Hear Me Calling or something like that, or Rank Stranger. It was going to be us reliving that song our way, pretty similar to the way we heard it in the first place, that we're touching. It's just like looking at old family photographs. You just like seeing those, that old house and those old people who, you know, go with it. So tastes wander all over the place. Some people just always want to hear something brand new. Well, okay, that's okay. And who's this guy? Stash Weislew, I think is how you pronounce his name. And I wish I remembered who he's playing with now, but he's an interesting guitar player, and he has these songs that sound like they're going to be straight bluegrass, but they sort of, I don't know, they go into a kaleidoscope mode somehow or another is the way I could say it. Trey Wellington has a song like that in the band that he does. They do Down the Road by Flattin' Scruggs, except when they get to a certain point in the verse, they sort of float into jam territory, and then they get right back to bluegrass. And Billy Strings, I've heard him, you know, where he starts off with like a Doc Watson tune, and before you know it, everything's tie-dyed and tattoos and everything, and then he's back. And, you know, I think more power to you. If this is a good way to connect with people, just do it, as long as you do it well and put your soul into it, and you're not just doing it to, you know, dangle the latest fashion in front of people and have them cash in, you know. So you asked for the nutshell. First I said it's just whatever, and then I elaborated. But I think it's all healthy, you know. As long as the trunk of the tree is solid, then there can be a lot of branches.
Wrapping up our episode on Pete Wernick with his song Spring Break from his solo 1993 album On a Roll, which was the first song he wrote after Hot Rise disbanded, although they reunited and released their collection When I'm Free in 2014. I looked up the guitar player he mentioned there, Stash Weislouch. Stash is short for Stanislaw, and he describes himself as an avant-garde bluegrass guitarist. His latest album is titled Sings and Plays Bluegrass Volume 2. Thank you so much for listening. We're grateful that you're here and for spreading awareness of what we're doing. It is as easy as telling a friend and following this podcast on your platform of choice. From there, it takes just a moment to give us a top rating and, where possible, like on Apple, a review. It makes a great difference because the more top reviews and ratings we get, The more visible we become to everyone on those platforms, which means that more people, just like you, will connect with artists we profile here. Can you think of a fellow music fan who says they don't like bluegrass? I bet Pete Wernick might be able to change their mind. This series is a part of the lineup of both Public Radio WNCW and Osiris Media, with all the Osiris shows available at osirispod.com. You can also hear new episodes on Bluegrass Planet Radio at bluegrassplanetradio.com. Thanks to Corey Askew for producing the radio adaptations of this series on Public Radio WNCW, where we worked with Joshua Ming, who wrote and performed our theme songs. I'm your host and producer, Joe Kendrick, and this is Southern Songs and Stories, the music of the South and the artists who make it.
I'd say that if a person has fairly well-defined tastes, they could still find stuff within bluegrass that really suits them. And here's another little quote. This is from the first Bluegrass Festival. Don Reno's on stage, and he's reminiscing with Bill Monroe and Benny Martin, and other people are up there talking about their careers in bluegrass. And he says, you know, bluegrass will never die. Of course, you wouldn't say that unless you were a little worried that it might. But he said, you know, there's seven different moods in bluegrass. And he never did name them. But I thought, oh, that's like seven dwarfs, you know, sleazy, grump, or sneezy, grumpy, you know, whatever, angry, spooky. So there could be a lot more dwarfs of, the flavors of bluegrass. But when I talk to banjo players, they say, you know, you don't have to use the same licks for every song. There are some songs that lick won't work in because it's too happy of a lick. It just sounds bright and snazzy, and this is about somebody who might get murdered, or this is about somebody who's on a train leaving their former life because they were done wrong and now they're mad. And you have to find some way to convey that even as a banjo player, which a lot of banjo players think, well, I memorized all those licks. What am I going to do? I say, well, just think about what the song's about and see what comes out of your hands to make sounds. You know, you'll have a different touch. You'll play different types of notes. There are some notes that are bluesy notes, and you'll gravitate toward those or not. If it's a happy song on a spring day, you're not going to use those. And that helps people understand that there's depth to the music, that's not just about foot tapping and yee-haw and listen to that banjo kind of thing. That, you know, that's part of it, obviously, but there's a lot to it. And I think anybody, whether you're DJ programming a program or a band presenting to different kinds of audiences, it's good to know the different kinds of moods that you can create. And create like a little bit of a, I don't know, it's like a book of short stories. And if they're good short stories, then people will like it for sure.